Willemstad's driver pulled up to his building on Park Avenue, just across from Lenox Hill Hospital. Dashing under its green awning, Willemstad, tired and depressed, rode up the elevator to his seventh-floor apartment. Pacing in his kitchen, he recounted the day's events to his wife, Carol. Before turning in for bed, Willemstad checked his BlackBerry one last time. David Herzog, the company's controller, and a man who had been working behind the scenes non-stop for the past weekend to keep the firm afloat, had sent him an email. The timestamp was 11:54 p.m. The subject line, Last Steps. Thank you for taking on this very difficult challenge. The events that unfolded tonight were set in motion long ago. Before you leave office, I ask only one thing. Please clean the slate for Mr. Liddy. I urge the following dismissals immediately. Schreiber, Lewis and McGinn, Neuger and Scott, Benzinger, Kelly, Caslow, Dooley. While this may seem a bit harsh, this group of executives each have shown in their own ways a clear pattern of ineptness that contributed to the destruction of one of America's greatest companies. Please don't make Mr. Liddy figure this out on his own. I mean no disrespect to these individuals, but the 120,000 employees around the world deserve better, and some sense of accountability for what just happened. We need leadership, and these individuals are simply not leaders. Respectfully yours, David. Willemstad, standing in the hallway in his boxer shorts, just shook his head in disbelief. Chapter 17. When Tim Geithner began his run on Wednesday morning along the southern tip of Manhattan and up the East River just after 6 o'clock, the sun had yet to come up. He was tired and stressed, having slept only several hours in one of the three tiny, grubby bedrooms in the New York Fed's headquarters. As he stared at the Statue of Liberty and the first of the morning's commuter ferries from Staten Island gliding across the harbor, he tried desperately to clear his mind. For 5 days his brain had been trapped in a maze of numbers, huge, inconceivable, abstract numbers, ranging in the span of 24 hours from zero for Lehman to $85 billion for AIG. $85 billion was more than the annual budgets of Singapore and Taiwan combined. Who could even begin to understand a figure of that size? Geithner had hoped the sum was sufficient, and that the crisis would finally be over. Those ferries, freighted with office workers, gave him pause. This is what it was all about, he thought to himself. The people who rise at dawn to get into their jobs, all of whom rely to some extent on the financial industry to help power the economy. Never mind the staggering numbers, never mind the ruthless complexity of structured finance and derivatives, nor the million-dollar bonuses of those who made bad bets. This is what saving the financial industry is really about, he reminded himself, protecting ordinary people with ordinary jobs. But as he passed the South Street Seaport, and then under the Brooklyn Bridge, he had inadvertently begun thinking about what fresh hell the day would bring. He was most anxious about the latest shocking development. A giant money market fund, reserve primary fund, had broken the buck a day earlier, which meant that the value of the fund's assets had fallen to below $1 per share, in this case, 97 cents. Money market funds were never supposed to do that. They were one of the least risky investments available, providing investors with minuscule returns in exchange for total security. But the Reserve Primary Fund had chased a higher yield, a 4.04% annual return, the highest in the industry, by making risky bets, including $785 million in Lehman paper. Investors had started liquidating their accounts, which in turn forced managers to impose a 7-day moratorium on redemptions. Nobody, Geithner worried, knew just how extensive the damage could end up being. Between the money market funds being under pressure, Geithner thought, and billions of dollars of investors' money locked up inside the now bankrupt Lehman Brothers, that meant only one thing. The two remaining broker-dealers, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, could actually be next. The panic was already palpable in John Mack's office at Morgan Stanley's Times Square headquarters. Sitting on his sofa with his lieutenants, Chama and Gorman, drinking coffee from paper cups, he was railing, The major news on Wednesday morning, he thought, should have been the strength of Morgan Stanley's earnings report, which he had released the afternoon before, a day early, to stem any fears of panic about the firm following the Lehman debacle. His stock had fallen 28% in a matter of hours on Tuesday, and he decided he needed to do something to turn it around. The quarterly earnings report had been a good one, better than that of Goldman Sachs, which had announced their earnings Tuesday morning and also had suffered, but not nearly as much. Morgan had reported $1.43 billion in profits, down a mere 3% from the quarter a year earlier. But the headline on the Wall Street Journal was gnawing at him. Goldman, Morgan now stand alone, fight on or fold. And as the futures markets were already indicating, his attempt to show strength and vitality had largely failed to impress. Apart from the new anxiety about money market funds and general nervousness about investment banks, he was facing a more serious problem than anyone on the outside realized. At the beginning of the week, Morgan Stanley had had $178 billion in the tank, money available to fund operations and to lend to their major hedge fund clients. But in the past 24 hours, more than $20 billion of it had been withdrawn, as hedge fund clients demanded it back, in some cases closing their prime brokerage accounts entirely. "The money's walking out of the door," Chamat told Mac. "Nobody gives a shit about loyalty," Mac railed. He had wanted to cut off the flow of funds, but up until now had been persuaded by Chamat to keep wiring the balances. "To put the gates up," Chamat warned, "would be a sign of weakness." The question was, how much more could they afford to let go? "We can't do this forever," Chamat said. While Mac was beginning to believe the hedge funds were conspiring against the firm, "This is what they did to Dick," he roared. There was fresh evidence that some of them actually did need the cash. Funds that had accounts at Lehman's London office couldn't get at them and came begging to Morgan Stanley and Goldman. As far as Mac was concerned, they needed to keep paying out money. He had spent years building their prime brokerage business into a major profit center. 89 of the top 100 hedge funds in the world traded through Morgan Stanley. It was essential in the midst of a crisis that the firm not display even the slightest sign of panic, or the entire franchise would be lost. "We are confident," he said. "We cannot be weak and we cannot be confused." Under normal circumstances, John Mack could be unflappable. The previous day he'd even been out on the floor, as was his habit, chatting with traders and eating a slice of pizza. But in his office that morning, he was starting to come unwound. There was just too much to do, too many options to explore, too many things to worry about. The night before, he'd received a call from his old friend Stephen R. Volk, a vice chairman at Citigroup and former lawyer who years earlier had helped Mack engineer the merger with Dean Witter. Now, Volk, ostensibly calling to offer congratulations on the earnings report, quietly planted the seed of another merger with Citi. "Look, John, we're here for you. We're not aggressive. And if you want to do something strategically to put us together, we would like to talk to you," Volk said. It was potentially explosive news. A merger between Morgan Stanley and Citigroup would be like combining Microsoft and Intel. Mac, Chama, and Gorman batted around the idea. Given the pressure on the broker-dealer model, merging with Citigroup would give it a stable base of deposits. J.P. Morgan and Citigroup were the only two left of the big, strong banks. They had all heard about Bank of America's conference call on Monday regarding its deal with Merrill Lynch and couldn't ignore Ken Lewis's comments, all but declaring the broker-dealer model officially dead. "For 7 years, I've said that the commercial banks would eventually own the investment banks because of funding issues," Lewis said. "I still think that. The golden era of investment banking is over." Gorman, at least for the moment, was thinking that he might well be right. "Do you think we should call Citigroup back?" he asked. Mac nodded and asked his assistant to phone Vikram Pandit's office. The two men knew each other well. Pandit, then at Morgan Stanley, had been given a big promotion by Mac in 2000, but had never been particularly close. "Steve tells me you want to do a deal," Mac said when Pandit got on the line. "It's tough out there," Mac continued. "We're looking at our options." "Well, we'd like to be helpful," Pandit said, "and this could be the time to do something." But before he got too far, he said, "I'll come back to you. I need to talk to my board." The black and orange screen flickered as Hank Paulson skimmed the updates about the Reserve Primary Fund on his Bloomberg terminal. With $62.6 billion in assets, the fund was a major player, and as a result of its troubles, doubt, he could see right in front of him, was starting to spread throughout the rest of the field. "We've got an emergency," Ken Wilson said, coming into Paulson's office and ticking off a list of panicked CEOs who had begun phoning him that morning at 6:30. Larry Fink of BlackRock, Bob Kelly of Bank of New York Mellon, Rick Waddell of Northern Trust, and Jim Cracchiolo at Ameriprise. "They're telling me people are clamoring for redemptions, hundreds of billions of dollars where people want out," Wilson said. "People are concerned about anyone who has any exposure to Lehman paper." Paulson fidgeted nervously. The Lehman-induced panic was spreading like a plague. The Black Death of Wall Street. The money market industry needed to be shored up. Wilson also told him that he was hearing that Morgan Stanley was coming under pressure from hedge funds seeking redemptions as well. And if Morgan Stanley were to go, Goldman, the firm where both had spent their entire careers, would likely be the next in line. "Another day, another crisis," Paulson said with a nervous laugh that betrayed an uneasy sense that he was truly beginning to panic himself. Paulson's instinctive response had been serial deal-making, the private sector's solution to systemic problems. Firms consolidated, covered one another's weaknesses. But this situation didn't feel normal in that respect. Behind every problem lurked another problem. He may have been praised for not bailing out Lehman, but he could see now that the unintended consequences had been devastating. The confidence that had supported the financial system had been upended. No one knew the rules of engagement anymore. They pretended they were drawing a line in the sand with Lehman Brothers, but now, 2 days later, they're doing another bailout. Nouriel Roubini, a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business, complained that morning. And now he could understand it. Commercial paper and money markets. That was his bread and butter, Goldman's specialty. The crisis was hitting close to home. Across town, Kevin Warsh, a 38-year-old governor at the Federal Reserve, whose office was a few doors down from Bernanke's, was having his own worries. He was just finishing up a conference call with Bernanke and central bankers in Europe and Asia, in which they explained what they had just done with AIG. Jean-Claude Trichet, the president of the European Central Bank, had been furious with them for their decision to let Lehman fail, and was lobbying Bernanke to go to Congress to implement a large government bailout for the entire industry to restore confidence. But Warsh was nervous about a different issue. Morgan Stanley, where he had worked as an M&A banker before leaving 7 years earlier to become special assistant to the president for economic policy. He could tell that his former firm was quickly losing confidence in the marketplace. To him, there was an obvious solution to its problems. Morgan Stanley should buy Wachovia, a commercial bank with a large deposit base that itself was struggling and might need a merger partner. Given that no one at Treasury was allowed to talk to Bob Steele now that he had become CEO of Wachovia, worrying about that firm had become Warsh's responsibility. And he increasingly had more to worry about. Wachovia's 2006 acquisition of Golden West, the California-based mortgage originator, was turning into a catastrophe, saddling Wachovia with a giant pile of bad debt that was beginning to reveal itself. There was no way the bank would make it on its own, he thought. But like Paulson with Goldman, Warsh had his own conflict of interest problem with Morgan Stanley. So he sought out Scott Alvarez, the Fed's general counsel, and requested a letter clearing him to make contact with his former employer, based on an overwhelming public interest. Warsh contacted Steele and instructed him to call Mac in 20 minutes, which left him enough time to give Mac a heads up. Warsh then called Geithner and asked, "Do you want me to call John, or do you want to call John?" They decided to call him together. Despite its terminal illness, Lehman Brothers was bustling with activity. Legions of sleep-deprived, depressed traders, lawyers, and other employees were still working the phones and doing what they had to do before closing up the shop. Fresh on their minds was the memo that Dick Fuld had sent out the previous night. The past several months had been extraordinarily challenging, culminating in our bankruptcy filing, he wrote. This has been very painful on all of you, both personally and financially. For this, I feel horrible. To some angry employees, it was an extraordinary understatement that called to mind Emperor Hirohito's famous surrender broadcast on August 15, 1945, when he told a stunned nation that the war situation has developed not necessarily to Japan's advantage. But later that day, Bart McDade, Skip McGee, and Mark Shafir, working off of 4 hours sleep in 3 days, were able to announce a welcome bit of good news. Though it was far too late to save the entire firm, Lehman had an agreement to sell its U.S. operations for $1.75 billion. The buyer was Barclays, Lehman's one-time would-be savior, which ended up getting the part it wanted without having to acquire the whole firm. The deal would allow at least some of Lehman's 10,000 employees in the United States to keep their jobs. As McDade, McGee, and Shafir walked the floors, some employees stood up to applaud. Mac knew what Bob Steele was calling about, and he was happy to speak with him. Both men were graduates of Duke and members of the university board, and not long after Steele had taken over at Wachovia, Mac had gone down to see him in Charlotte to pitch Morgan Stanley as an advisor. No business had come out of the meeting. The bank had Goldman to help them sort through the Golden West quagmire, but the men realized they spoke the same language and agreed to stay in touch. "Very interesting times," Steele now said. "I imagine you've already heard from Kevin. He told me he thought we should connect." Steele went on, intentionally keeping the discussion vague until he gauged Mac's intentions. "There might be an opportunity for us. We're thinking about a lot of things. I think this could be the right time to talk. But we'd need to move fast." "I could see something," Mac replied, intrigued but noncommittal. "What's your timing?" "We're moving in real time," Steele said. Considering the meltdown in the markets, Mac thought it was at least worth talking. For Steele, a Morgan Stanley deal happened to be both commercially and personally attractive. All the tumult within the firm had left Mac without a clear successor. While he may not have wanted Mac's job immediately, their mutual friend Roy Bostock, a Morgan Stanley board member, had privately hinted to Steele that a deal between Morgan Stanley and Wachovia could present an elegant solution to Morgan's succession problems down the road. This could be Steele's big opportunity to finally run a top Wall Street firm. After speaking with Steele, Mac called Robert Scully, his top deal maker, and told him about the conversation. Scully had his doubts. He didn't know much about Wachovia's books, but what he did know alarmed him. He agreed, however, that at this point, no options could be automatically ruled out. Besides, Wachovia had one of the biggest, most solid deposit bases in the country, an extremely attractive feature as Morgan Stanley was watching its cash fly out the door. Scully in turn called Rob Kindler, a vice chairman, to tell him that Dave Carroll, Wachovia's head of business development, was coming to meet them on Thursday and get things started. In the relatively straight-laced banker culture of Morgan Stanley, Kindler was an outlier, loud, indiscreetly blunt, and predisposed to threadbare old suits. In the 1990s, he had been a star lawyer at Kravath, Swain & Moore. But he always preferred banking. He left law and originally joined J.P. Morgan. A constant prankster, he soon had hats made with the slogan, "One firm, one team, bribe a leader," mocking J.P. Morgan's slogan of, "One firm, one team, be a leader." Despite his idiosyncrasies, when it came to deal-making, his advice was highly valued. Kindler didn't initially like the notion of a Wachovia merger either, he told Scully, and took a reflexively cynical view. Let's put this in context for a moment. Bob Steele comes from Goldman. Wachovia's investment bankers are Goldman. Paulson is obviously from Goldman. The only reason we're having this meeting with Wachovia is because Goldman won't do the deal. Scully had been thinking much the same thing, but hadn't been willing to say so. I don't know, he said. Seems like a bad idea. But Kindler couldn't help himself and soon began to wrap his brain around the possibilities of the deal. It could be good for us, he told Scully. It brings us a deposit base, a regional banking franchise. Let's see how it plays out. Scully and Kindler got Jonathan Prusen, co-head of Morgan Stanley's financial institutions practice, to start running the numbers on Wachovia. The obvious concern was its gargantuan subprime exposure, some $120 billion worth. As the Wachovia due diligence got underway, Mac got a call back from Vikram Pandit, delivering what amounted to a soft no on the merger talks. "The answer is no, the timing isn't right, but at some point we'd like to do something." Mac clicked off, exasperated. Wachovia was nobody's idea of a dream date, but at the moment, it was the only girl at the dance. This is an economic 9/11. There was chilling silence in Hank Paulson's office as he spoke. Nearly 24 Treasury staffers had assembled there Wednesday morning, sitting on windowsills, on the arms of sofas, or on the edge of Paulson's desk, scribbling on legal pads. Looming over them was a portrait of Alexander Hamilton, a copy of a portrait painted in 1792, when the young nation endured its first financial panic. A Treasury associate, William Duer, who also happened to be a personal friend of Hamilton's, had used inside information to build up a huge position in government securities. When bond prices slid, Duer could not cover his debts, setting off a panic. Hamilton decided against bailing out his friend, but did direct the Treasury to buy government securities, steadying the market, a long-forgotten but potentially instructive model of government intervention. Paulson was seated in a chair in the corner, slouching, nervously tapping his stomach. He had a pained look on his face as he explained to his inner circle at Treasury that, in the past 4 hours, the crisis had reached a new height, one he could only compare with the calamity 7 years earlier, almost to the week. While no lives may have been at stake, companies with century-long histories and hundreds of thousands of jobs lay in the balance. The entire economy, he said, was on the verge of collapsing. He had been on the phone that morning with Jamie Dimon, who had expressed his own anxiety. Paulson was no longer worried just about investment banks. He was worried about General Electric, the world's largest company, and an icon of American innovation. He was hearing that the conglomerate's commercial paper, which it used to fund its day-to-day operations, could stop rolling. He had heard murmurs that J.P. Morgan had stopped lending to Citigroup, that Bank of America had stopped making loans to McDonald's franchises, that Treasury bills were trading for under 1% interest, as if they were no better than cash, as if the full faith of the government had suddenly become meaningless. Paulson knew this was his financial panic, and perhaps was the most important moment of his tenure at Treasury, and possibly of his entire career. The night before, Bernanke had told him that the time had come for a systemic solution. Deciding the fate of each financial firm one at a time wasn't working. It had been 6 months between Bear and Lehman, but if Morgan Stanley went down, probably no more than 6 hours would pass before Goldman did too. The big banks would follow, and God only knew what might happen after that. And so, Paulson stood in front of his staff in search of a holistic solution, a solution that would require intervention. He still hated the idea of bailouts, but now he knew he needed to succumb to the reality of the moment. "The only way to stop this thing may be to come up with a fiscal response," he said. They needed to start thinking about what kind of program they could put together, and while he wasn't sure that that approach would even be politically feasible, it had to be explored. He told the staff that he knew and accepted that he would be subjected to an enormous amount of political flack. He had already been criticized for the bailout of AIG, with Barney Frank mockingly declaring that he was going to propose a resolution to call September 15th, the day Lehman filed for bankruptcy, as Free Market Day. "The national commitment to the free market lasted one day," Frank said. "It was Monday." Senator Jim Bunning, Republican from Kentucky, was decrying that once again the Fed has put the taxpayers on the hook for billions of dollars to bail out an institution that put greed ahead of responsibility. Richard Shelby, Republican from Alabama, added that he profoundly disagrees with the decision to use taxpayer dollars to bail out a private company. The first order of business, Paulson said, was addressing the money market crisis. Steve Shaffron, a former Goldman banker, suggested that the Treasury could simply step in and guarantee the funds. "We have the authority," he said, citing the Gold Reserve Act of 1934, which set aside a fund, now totaling $50 billion, to stabilize essential markets. "The key," Shaffron said, was that all they needed to access it was presidential approval, bypassing Congress. "Do it," Paulson said, and Shaffron slipped out of the room to put the process in motion. There was, however, no such easy solution to begin stabilizing the banks. Phil Swagel, the wonky Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy, emphasized the necessity of being bold and not avoiding addressing the problems for fear of political fallout. "You don't want to be running Japan," he said. Swagel and Neil Kashkari dusted off the 10-page break-the-glass paper they had prepared the previous spring. In the event of a liquidity crisis, the plan called for the government to step in and buy toxic assets directly from the lenders, thereby putting right their balance sheets and enabling them to keep extending credit. The authors knew that executing their plan would be complicated. The banks would fight furiously over the pricing of the assets. But it would keep the government's involvement in the day-to-day businesses as minimal as possible, something conservatives strongly desired. "This is what we should do," Kashkari told Paulson. He had been involved in Hope Now, one of the government's early efforts at helping distressed homeowners, and had learned firsthand how difficult it would be to get the banks making new loans as long as they were carrying bad loans on their balance sheets. On the speakerphone from New York, where he still was embroiled in the AIG situation, Paulson's advisor Dan Jester argued that the purchasing of assets was too cumbersome and recommended instead that capital be injected directly into the institutions. "The more bang for your buck is to put capital in," he said, explaining that even if the market continued to fall, it would help the banks manage the downturn. The difficulty with that approach, countered Assistant Secretary David Nason, was the specter of nationalization. If the government put money into firms, it became a de facto owner, which is precisely what most of the people in the room wanted to avoid. "Are people going to think we're going to AIG them?" he asked, already using the government's investment less than 24 hours earlier as a verb. Paulson had liked the break-the-glass idea when it had first been presented to him, and was now leaning to move in that direction. AIG was a disaster they couldn't afford to repeat, and buying the assets maintained a clear border between government and the private sector. The job now was to begin preparing the outlines of legislation for Congress. They were going to need a ton of money, and they were going to need it immediately. He assigned Kashkari and a team of staffers the task of fleshing out the idea. Break the Glass might have been an interesting document in theory, but it lacked details and was far from executable. He gave them 24 hours to fill them in. Before ending the meeting, Paulson asked, "How much is this going to cost?" Kashkari, who had originally estimated the expense at $500 billion back in the spring, said gravely, "It's going to be more. I don't know. Maybe even double." Dismissing everyone with a warning that their conversation had been confidential, Paulson then called Geithner to compare notes. "You cannot go out and talk about big numbers with regard to capital needs for banks without inviting a run," Geithner told him. "If you don't get the authority, I'm certain you'll spark a freaking panic. You have to be careful about not going public until you know you're going to get it." By mid-afternoon Wednesday, Morgan Stanley's stock had fallen 42%. The rumors were flying. The latest gossip had the company as a trading partner with AIG, with more than $200 billion at risk. The gossip was inaccurate, but it didn't matter. Hedge funds continued to seek nearly $50 billion in redemptions. Hoping to poach Morgan Stanley's hedge fund clients, Deutsche Bank was sending out flyers with the headline, "DB, a solid counterparty." John Mack was meeting with his brain trust, already anticipating what had become a grim end-of-day ritual. At 2:45 p.m., hedge funds would start pulling money out of their prime brokerage accounts, asking for all the credit and margin balances. At 3 o'clock, the Fed window would close, leaving the firm without access to additional capital until the following morning. Then, at 3:02, the spread on Morgan Stanley's credit default swaps, the cost of buying insurance against the firm's defaulting, would soar. Finally, its clearing bank, J.P. Morgan, would call and ask for more collateral to protect it. "It's outrageous what's going on here," Mack almost shouted, arguing that a raid on Morgan Stanley's stock was immoral if not illegal. Intellectually, he understood the benefit that shorts provide in the market. After all, many were his own clients. But at risk now was his own survival. Colm Kelleher, Morgan Stanley's CFO, was more fatalistic. The short sellers couldn't be stopped, he believed, or even necessarily blamed. They were market creatures, doing what they had to do to survive. They are cold-blooded reptiles, he told Mac. They eat what's in front of them. Mac had just gotten off the phone with one of his closest friends, Arthur J. Sandberg, the founder of Pequot Capital Management, who had called about withdrawing some money. Look, if you want to take some money out, take money out, Mac told him, frustrated. John, I really don't want to do it. But my fund-to-funds accounts are saying I have too much exposure to Morgan Stanley, he said, citing the rumors about its health. Take your money, Mac told him. Then you can tell all your peers to take their credit balances out. Mac believed negative speculation was purposely being spread by his rivals and repeated uncritically on CNBC. He was so furious with the bullshit coverage that he called to complain to Jeff Immelt, the CEO of GE, which owned CNBC as part of its NBC Universal unit. There's not a lot we can do about it, Immelt could only say, apologetically. Tom Nides, Mac's chief administrative officer, thought they needed to go on the offensive. Nides, a former CEO of Burson Marsteller, the public relations giant, had been one of Mac's closest advisors for several years, his influence so great that he had persuaded the lifelong Republican to support Hillary Clinton. He now encouraged Mac to start working the phones in Washington and impress upon them the need to instate a ban against short selling. We've got to shut down these assholes, he told Mac. Gary Lynch, Morgan Stanley's chief legal officer and a former enforcement chief at the SEC, volunteered to call Richard Ketchum, the head of regulation of the New York Stock Exchange, and put a bug in his ear about suspicious trading. I'm in favor of free markets, and I'm in favor of free streets, too. But when you have people walking down the streets with bats, maybe it's time for a curfew, he said. Nides set up a series of phone calls for Mac, who also contacted Chuck Schumer and Hillary Clinton, pleading with them to call the SEC to press the case on his behalf. This is about jobs, real people, he told them. After speaking with Christopher Cox, the head of the SEC, however, he was in an even fouler mood. Cox, a free market zealot, seemed to Mac to be almost intentionally ineffectual, as if that were the proper role of government regulators. There was nothing he was going to do about the shorts, or about anything at all, for that matter. Paulson, who was next on his call list, was clearly sympathetic to Mac's cause to ban the short sellers, but it was unclear whether he could do anything to help him. I know it, John, I know it, he said, trying to pacify him. But this is for Cox to decide. I'll see what I can do. Mac then contacted his most serious rival, Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman, desperate for an ally. These guys are taking a run at my stock. They're driving my CDS out, Mac said frantically. Lloyd, you guys are in the same boat as I am. He then made a request of Blankfein to appear on CNBC with him as a show of force. While Blankfein kept a television in his office, he was so disgusted with what he called Charlie Gasparino's rumor-mongering that he turned it off in protest. That's not my thing, he told Mac. I don't do TV. As Goldman wasn't in total crisis mode, Blankfein explained, he was disinclined to join Mac in a war on the shorts until he absolutely needed to. Making little progress, Nides had another, perhaps shrewder, angle to play. He could call Andrew Cuomo, the New York State Attorney General, who badly needed a cause to resurrect his political fortunes. Nides had a hunch that he might be willing to put a scare into the shorts. It was an easy populist message to get behind. Rich hedge fund managers were betting against teetering banks amid a financial crisis. Everybody remembered what Elliot Spitzer had managed to do to Wall Street from the same platform. When Nides reached Cuomo, he pitched on announcing an investigation of the shorts. Cuomo had voiced concerns about short-selling before, but this would be a shot across the bow. If you do this, Nides said, we'll come out and praise you. Nides knew Mac would be reluctant. He'd be assailing his own clients. But this was a matter of survival. Before the market closed, Mac sent the following email to the entire staff. To all employees, from John Mac. I know all of you are watching our stock price today, and so am I. After the strong earnings, and $179 billion in liquidity we announced yesterday, which virtually every equity analyst highlighted in their notes this morning, there is no rational basis for the movements in our stock or credit default spreads. What's happening out there? It's very clear to me. We're in the midst of a market controlled by fear and rumors, and short sellers are driving our stock down. You should know that the management committee and I are taking every step possible to stop this irresponsible action in the market. We have talked to Secretary Paulson and the Treasury. We have talked to Chairman Cox and the SEC. We also are communicating aggressively with our long-term shareholders, our counterparties, and our clients. I would encourage all of you to communicate with your clients as well, and make sure they know about our strong performance and strong capital position. It's ridiculous that I can't deal with Goldman at a time like this, Paulson complained to his general counsel, Bob Hoyt. He was supposed to take part in a 3 o'clock p.m. call with Bernanke, Geithner, and Cox to discuss Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. But unless he could get a waiver, he would be unable to participate. With Morgan Stanley on the ropes, Paulson had been growing increasingly worried about Goldman, and if Goldman were to topple, it would, he believed, represent a complete destruction of the system. He'd had enough of recusing himself. Part of him regretted signing the original ethics letter agreeing not to get involved in any matter related to Goldman for his entire tenure. At the time, it seemed a good-faith gesture to go above and beyond the typical one-year moratorium on dealing with former employers, but now, he thought, it had come back to bite him. Geithner had raised this very issue back in March, after the Bear Stearns deal. "You know, Hank, if another one of these banks goes," he said, "I don't know who would have the ability to take them over, other than Goldman. And we have to do something about your waiver recusal situation, because I don't know how we can do one of these without you." Given the extreme situation in the market, Hoyt told Paulson he thought it was only fair that he try to seek a waiver. Hoyt had, in fact, already even drafted the material needed to request one. As Paulson had sold all of his Goldman stock before he took office, Hoyt thought he could easily tell the Office of Government Ethics that Paulson had no conflict, apart from his remaining stake in Goldman's pension plan, but that constituted only a small part of his overall wealth. After he turned 65 years old, Goldman would pay him $10,533 a year. Paulson appreciated that the optics of receiving a waiver to engage with his former employer would only feed the continuing conspiracy theories about his efforts to help Goldman, but he felt he had no other choice, and he hoped it would remain a secret. He and Hoyt discussed keeping the existence of a waiver confidential. Hoyt reached out to Fred F. Fielding, counsel to the White House and a longtime Washington hand who knew his way around the system, and to Bernard J. Knight, Jr., the DAEO, or Designated Agency Ethics Official, at Treasury, who was attending a conference in Florida with another colleague from the White House Ethics Office. With virtually no pushback, given the gravity of the situation, they quickly accepted Hoyt's recommendation. "I have determined that the magnitude of the government's interest in your participation in matters that might affect or involve Goldman Sachs clearly outweighs the concern that your participation may cause a reasonable person to question the integrity of the government's programs and operations," Knight wrote in an email. Fielding's office made it official by having a copy of the formal waiver walked over to the Treasury building. On White House letterhead, it began, "This memorandum provides a waiver. In your position as Secretary of the United States Department of the Treasury, you are responsible for serving the American people and strengthening national security by managing the U.S. government's finances effectively, promoting economic growth and stability, and ensuring the safety, soundness, and security of the United States and international financial systems. You currently have an interest in a defined benefit pension plan through your former employers, the Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated. Your total investment in this plan represents only a small fraction of your overall investment portfolio. For this reason, your financial interest in the plan is not so substantial as to be likely to affect the integrity of your services to the government. With this waiver, you may participate personally and substantially in the particular matters affecting this defined benefit pension plan, including the ability or willingness of the Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated to honor its obligations to you under this plan." Unknown to the public, Paulson was now officially free to help Goldman Sachs. "Stop the insanity, we need a timeout," was the subject line of Glenn Shore's email. An analyst at UBS, who covered the banking industry, Shore had sent the missive to accompany his latest report to his clients on Wednesday afternoon. But by the time the market closed, with Morgan Stanley's shares plummeting 24% to $21.75, after dropping to $16.08 earlier in the day, and Goldman's plunging 14% to $114.50 after hitting a low of $97.78, Shore's email was being forwarded all around town. "We think investors should be focused on risk management and performance, and not just whether you have retail deposits. Banks go out of business too, last we checked. And at this rate, following money fund redemptions, deposits could be around the corner. In our view, a lack of confidence and forced consolidation into firms that are too big to fail can't be the final solution," he wrote. "The world should really be concerned about this, because if we continue to squeeze the financial system's balance sheet and see fewer players in the business, the available credit to corporations and hedge funds will shrivel up, and the cost of capital will continue to skyrocket across the board." The email eventually found its way to the Treasury building, where Paulson was returning phone calls from a long list, trying to get a realistic view of what was taking place on Wall Street. Among the people he spoke with was Steve Schwartzman, the chairman of Blackstone Group, the private equity giant. "Hank, how's your day going?" Schwartzman jibed when the call was connected. "Not well. What do you see out there?" Paulson asked. The conversation quickly turned serious. "I have to tell you, the system's going to collapse in the next few days. I doubt you're going to be able to open the banks on Monday," Schwartzman said, deeply spooked by what he was seeing. "People are shorting financial institutions. They're withdrawing money from brokerage firms because they don't want to be the last people in, like in Lehman, which is going to lead to the collapse of Goldman and Morgan Stanley. Everybody is just pursuing his self-interest," Schwartzman told him. "You have to do something." "We're working on some things," Paulson said. "What do you think we should do?" "You have to approach what you're doing from the perspective of being a sheriff in a western town where things are out of control," Schwartzman replied. "And you have to do the equivalent of just walking onto Main Street and shooting your gun up in the air a few times to establish that you're in charge, because right now no one is in charge." Paulson just listened, trying to picture himself in that role. "What do you recommend?" "Well, the first thing you could do is stop short selling of financial institutions. Forget whether it's effective in removing the pressure, although it might be. What will be accomplished is that you will scare the participants in the market, and they will recognize that things are going to change, and they can't continue to invest in the exact same way. And that will force people to pause," Schwartzman said. "Okay, that's not a bad idea," Paulson agreed. "We've been talking about that. I could do that. What else do you got?" "I would stop the ability of people to withdraw, you know, transfer their brokerage accounts," Schwartzman continued. "Nobody really wants to transfer their account out of Goldman or Morgan. They just feel they have to do it, so they're not the last person on a sinking ship." "I don't have the powers to do that," Paulson replied. "You could get rid of the ability for people to write credit default swaps on financial institutions," Schwartzman offered as an alternative, "which is putting enormous pressure on financial institutions." "I don't have the powers to do that either," Paulson protested. Schwartzman, concerned that he wasn't getting through to Paulson, replied, "Look, you're going to have to announce something very big to rescue the system, some huge amount of money that gets utilized to address the problems of the system." "Well, we're not ready to do that yet," Paulson told him. "We've got some ideas," he said. "I don't think that it's relevant if you haven't fully baked everything," Schwartzman said. "You need an announcement tomorrow to stop the collapse, and you've got to figure something out that will grab people's attention." "What's wrong?" John Mack asked in alarm as his CFO, Colm Kelleher, walked into his office late Wednesday, his face ashen. "John," Kelleher said in his staccato British inflections, "we're going to be out of money on Friday." He had been nervously watching the firm's tank, its liquid assets, shrink, the way an airline pilot might stare at the fuel gauge while circling an airport, waiting for landing clearance. "That can't be," Mac said anxiously. "Do me a favor. Go back to the financing desk. Go through it again." Every hour was bringing a new problem. The internal memo he had sent out earlier, decrying short sellers, had started leaking out, and now several prominent hedge fund clients that used shorting strategies, some simply to hedge their exposures to other securities, were closing their Morgan Stanley accounts in protest. "It's one thing to complain, but another to put out a memo blaming your clients," railed Jim Chenos, the short seller who famously unearthed the problems at Enron. He had been a Morgan Stanley client for 20 years, but now he was making his displeasure known by pulling $1 billion from his account at the firm. Julian H. Robertson, Jr., the founder of Tiger Management, one of the first and most successful hedge funds, called the firm apoplectically, though he stopped short of redeeming the money he kept with Morgan Stanley. As annoyed as they might have been by the attack on the shorts, the firm's clients were about to become a good deal angrier. Mack was reviewing draft language for the statement he would publish the following day in support of Cuomo's investigation into short selling, though he knew full well that his language would infuriate his clients and send even more of them packing. Mack didn't believe he had a choice but to lend his support. Morgan Stanley applauds Attorney General Cuomo for taking strong action to root out improper short selling of financial stocks. By initiating a wide-ranging investigation of this manipulative and fraudulent conduct, Attorney General Cuomo is showing decisive leadership in trying to help stabilize the financial markets. We also support his call for the SEC to impose a temporary freeze on short selling of financial stocks, given the extreme and unprecedented movements in the market that are unsupported by the fundamentals of individual stocks. Kelleher returned to Mack's office 30 minutes after having been sent to review the firm's balances again, slightly less shaken, but only slightly. After finding some additional money trapped in the system between trades that hadn't yet settled, he revised his prognosis. "Maybe we'll make it through early next week." Paulson was hunched over his telephone, straining to hear Bernanke and Geithner on the speakerphone. It was late Wednesday, and the Treasury staff was already girding for another all-nighter. Bernanke was making his frustration clear. He didn't believe the crisis could be solved by individual deals or some one-off solution. "We can't keep doing this," he insisted to Paulson, "both because we at the Fed don't have the necessary resources, and for reasons of democratic legitimacy, it's important that the Congress come in and take control of the situation." Paulson agreed in theory, but was concerned that Bernanke was underestimating the political calculus. "I understand that you guys don't want to be fighting this fire alone, but the worst outcome would be if I go ask, and they tell me to screw off," Paulson said. "We will then show that we're vulnerable, and we don't have the armaments we need." "There are no atheists in foxholes and no ideologues in financial crises," Bernanke, trotting out a phrase he had tried out on some Fed colleagues a day earlier, told Paulson, trying to persuade him that intervention was necessary. Paulson agreed, but said if they were going to proceed, he wanted to promote his plan to have the government buy toxic assets, a solution that he thought would be the most politically palatable, because it would be comparable to the Resolution Trust Corporation of the late 1980s. Congress created the RTC in 1989 to handle the more than $400 billion in loans and other assets held by 747 failed savings and loans as part of the S&L crisis. The RTC had been the recipient of a wide range of loans, properties, and bonds from the failed thrifts. Like the predicament Paulson currently faced, some of the assets were good, but most were bad, and some, including construction and development loans, had no discernible market. The task was daunting. L. William Seidman, the RTC chairman, initially estimated that even if the agency sold $1 million of assets a day, it would take 300 years to dispose of everything. By the time the RTC completed its job in 1995, a year ahead of its deadline, the cost to the taxpayers was nearly $200 billion in 2008 dollars, a much lower tab than what many had feared at the time the agency had been created. Paulson thought the idea had merit, and was buoyed by an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that morning, touting a similar plan by Paul A. Volcker, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Nicholas F. Brady, a former U.S. Treasury Secretary, and Eugene A. Ludwig, a former U.S. Comptroller of the Currency. This new government body would be able to buy up the troubled paper at fair market values, where possible, keeping people in their homes and businesses operating, Like the RTC, this mechanism should have a limited life and be run by nonpartisan professional management, they wrote. The pathology of this crisis is that, unless you get ahead of it and deal with it from strength, it devours the weakest link in the chain and then moves on to devour the next weakest link. On Thursday morning, Tom Nides, who lived in Washington and commuted every week to New York, woke up early at the Regency Hotel and went to the gym. As he read the New York Times on an elliptical machine, he nearly fell off when he came upon the front-page story, which ran under the headline, "As Fears Grow, Wall Street Titans See Shares Fall." Directly in the middle of the story was a quote citing two people who had been briefed on merger talks between Morgan Stanley and Citigroup, saying that John Mack had told Vikram Pandit, "We need a merger or we're not going to make it." Nides couldn't believe Mack even said that. He had been in the room for one of the calls with Pandit, and it didn't go like that, he thought. Morgan Stanley, Nides knew, could not afford that sort of coverage, whether or not it was true. The more people who knew it, the truer it would become. "Did you see this irresponsible piece of shit in the Times?" Nides asked when he got Mack on the phone. Mack, however, only read the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, and the New York Post, having canceled his Times subscription in protest after the Sulzberger family pulled its money from Morgan Stanley because one of its asset managers had decided to run a proxy contest against the Times ownership. Now, Mack had reason to be upset at the Times all over again, and he and his colleagues were furious with Pandit, who they were convinced must have leaked it. "You didn't say this, did you?" Nides asked. "No, no," Mack insisted. "I never said that. I definitely didn't use those words." Nides knew he needed to challenge the veracity of the quote immediately. He was already getting calls from other news organizations. "What fucking kind of reporter are you?" he berated one of the article's authors, Eric Dash, when he reached him on his cell phone. "You have to rescind the story." Mack, meanwhile, prepared to address his employees for the second time in 4 days, eager to offer them reassurance, especially after the Times story. He had invited Eugene A. Ludwig, chairman of Promontory Financial Group, and one of the authors of the editorial in the previous day's Wall Street Journal, advocating for a RTC-like structure, to join him this morning as his advisor. Battling a cold, his glasses slipping down his nose, Mack stood on Morgan Stanley's main trading floor, his speech piped into its employees around the world. He spoke in a plain, unscripted manner, his North Carolina accent perhaps more pronounced than usual. "You know, you've seen the cash position, you've seen our earnings, all that stuff. Unlike what people said about other firms, those numbers are real numbers," he told them. "We're clean, we're making money. We made a lot of money the last 8 days also. But it doesn't make any difference. We deal in a market today that financial chicanery, rumor, and innuendo are much more powerful than real results." He related a phone conversation with a good friend, a hedge fund manager who confided his fears about Morgan Stanley. Mack reassured the man, only to receive another call 4 hours later from the same fund manager about still another market rumor. "My point being, no matter what we say, there's another rumor that pops up." Mack acknowledged that the firm was examining all its options, while expressing bewilderment at how the industry had been turned upside down. "What I find remarkable is not too long ago, 2 months ago, 4 months ago, people said the Citibank model was broken, complicated, big, global, unmanageable. And now our model's broken. Is our model, and I include Goldman Sachs, is our model broken because we are not part of a bank? Is our model broken because we've consistently, in the last 3 quarters, delivered good earnings? Is our model broken because we could not have regulators who stepped in and take strong stands? That might be the issue here. I think the issues are, how do you get through chaos? This is chaos. It pains me to go on the floor and see how you guys look." Mack then addressed the most sensitive issue for his employees, the selling of stock. According to SEC regulations, employees could sell only during certain designated periods, such as immediately following an earnings report, which meant at the present. "I know this is a window period," Max said. "And I know some of you are very scared. Well, maybe all of us are very scared. You want to sell stock, sell your stock. I'm not going to look at it, and I don't care. I'm not selling. And there, well, John, you've got a lot of it. You don't have to worry about it. I do have a lot, and I do worry about it. But I really care much more about your getting peace of mind. So if you want to sell, sell. Do it. When the time came for questions from the staff, Stephen Roach, Morgan Stanley's unfailingly bearish economist, asked a pointed question about the shorts. Short sellers, John. Many, if not most of them, are clients of the firm. Put yourself in the room with one of these, quote, clients, unquote. What do you say to them? Mac drew a deep breath. Well, I thought long and hard about that, and my gut reaction is that I'm angry, and I want to tell them what I think, and I don't want to do business with you and all that other stuff. Then on my second breath I say, you know, they have their job to do, that's what they're doing. I am not going to get pulled into that kind of discussion. And this is what I wanted to say. I put a note here about being angry. We can be angry, we are angry, we are upset, and we just have to deal with it. We are not here to beat up on clients and tell them how they deserted us and all of that stuff. We're here to run this firm, work with our clients as best we can. Some don't want to do business. We'll deal with that later. Let them go. Let's stay focused on things that are productive. And venting and telling people what you think and calling them all the names you want to call them is not going to help us, he said, punctuating the point by adding, I love beating the shit out of people when they screwed us, but I'm not going there. And I don't want you to go there. The panic at Goldman Sachs could no longer be denied. Perhaps the greatest sign of anxiety was the fact that Gary Cohn, Goldman's co-president, who usually remained perched in his 30th floor office, had relocated himself to the office of Harvey M. Schwartz, head of Global Securities Division Sales, who had a glass wall looking out to the trading floor. The door was left open. He wanted to see and hear exactly what was going on. The Federal Reserve, along with the other central banks, had just announced plans to pump $180 billion to stimulate the financial system, but the scheme did not seem to be having any appreciable effect. Goldman's shares opened down 7.4%. CNBC, which was airing on flat-screen TVs hanging from the walls of Goldman's trading floor, had introduced a new bug on the bottom left-hand side of the screen that provocatively asked, Is your money safe? It was a question that Goldman clients were beginning to ask themselves. The firm's own CDS spreads had blown out in a way the firm had never seen before, indicating that investors were quickly beginning to believe the unthinkable, that Goldman, too, could falter. In 2 days, Goldman's stock had dropped from $133 to $108. Every 5 minutes, a salesman would tear into Schwartz's office with news of another hedge fund announcing its plan to move its money out of Goldman, and would hand Cohn a piece of paper with the hedge fund's phone number so he could talk some sense into them. With Morgan Stanley slowing down its payouts, some investors were now testing Goldman, asking for $100 million just to see if they could afford to pay. In every case, Cohn would wire the money immediately, concerned that if he didn't, the client would abandon the firm entirely. The good news for Goldman was that withdrawals were only slightly outpacing inflows. To some extent, it had been able to capitalize on the distress of others, as hedge funds needed to execute their trades somewhere. When Steve Cohen of SAC Capital transferred several billion over to Goldman, traders began to whoop it up on the floor. On the other hand, Stanley Druckenmiller, a George Soros acolyte worth more than $3.5 billion, had taken most of his money out earlier that week, concerned about the firm's solvency. If word got around that a hedge fund manager of Druckenmiller's reputation had lost confidence in Goldman, it alone could cause a run. Cohn called him and tried to convince him to return the money to the firm. I have a long memory, Cohn, who was taking this personally, told Druckenmiller, for whom he had even hosted a charity cocktail party in Druckenmiller's honor in his own apartment. Look, the one thing I'm doing is I'm learning who my friends are and who my enemies are, and I'm making lists. Druckenmiller, however, was unmoved. I don't really give a shit. It's my money, he shot back. Unlike most hedge funds, Druckenmiller's did consist primarily of his own money. It's my livelihood, he said. I've got to protect myself, and I don't really give a shit what you have to say. You can do whatever you want, Cohn said in carefully measured tones. But, he added, This will change our relationship for a long time. Half an hour before David Carroll and the Wachovia team were due to arrive at Morgan Stanley, Kindler called down to Scully. Kindler was in his office, peering out his window down at the camera crews camped outside the building. "Why are we having him meet us here, of all places?" Kindler asked. "There's reporters outside." "Don't worry, it'll be fine." Scully, who took the precaution of sneaking Carroll in via the employee entrance on 4th